As a way of introducing the instructions we'll be giving for this retreat, Mahasi practice instruction, I'd like to say that there are, I think, of two important domains or approaches to that support meditation practice, mindfulness practice. One is the instructions that we do, what we do, and the other is how we do it. And that there are many hows, maybe just as there are many what's to do, but the how is very important. It creates the context, it creates the atmosphere, it creates the attitude. It's kind of if you plant a seed into a field, if the field is infertile or dry, the seed won't germinate or grow into a plant. But if the soil in the field is rich and nutrients and moisture, and then the plant will grow maybe nicely. So the how I think of as the field in which the seed of the practice we do is held. So I'll say a few words about the how. I start by a personal story of when I was doing the Mahasi practice in Burma. I had a custom of starting in a particular unusual way that I never told Upandita, but I'll admit it to you. And that is, I have a custom that somehow, unplanned custom, that somehow I end up adapting lyrics from my youth into changing them slightly in my mind. And so I would start with one of these little one-line pieces of lyric from a song in the 60s. And I can't really sing, so that would ruin the retreat perhaps if I tried. But I will try to just kind of, I did it more like a chant for myself. And I would sit down, and I would take a deep breath, and then I'd let my breath out long and slow. Well, I said, I first hummed, and then I said the lyrics. And, you know, it maybe approximates what the song was, but I can't, you know, don't assume it's supposed to if you recognize the song. Just, you know, I don't know how I ended up with this. But I would go, got a whole lot of love. And if I'd made it a little bit longer, I would say, way down deep inside, got a whole lot of love. And that's how I would start. And that's like a how. Like I would establish certain field of how that had something like love or something is connected to it. And this idea of way down deep inside brought me inward to be embodied and present here, because I had learned that I had a wonderful, amazing ability to be disembodied from myself, kind of like I was outside of myself in this kind of way, by thinking a lot. The world of thoughts kind of took me someplace else, you know, and certainly wasn't here. And so the art of it all was to kind of turn that inside out or around, so that rather than being outside of myself or disconnected, I came home to myself and settled into the inside, so I was aware from the inside out, rather than only aware kind of outside, but I was aware of nothing outside either, just, you know, just thinking. And it was a wonderful way for me to start and settle in and be here and kind of evoke a certain how. And the idea of how, I think, is actually the way of being how is more important than the what. It kind of does more than just creates the soil, the field in which the what's can grow. It It might actually be the primary seed as well. It's both soil and seed. And maybe the practice that we do, what we do, maybe it's more like the rain or the water that's going to let it swell and grow or something. Or the sun that allows something to, you know, a plant to grow as well. And so the how could be many different ways that are supportive. Each of us probably has a different how that maybe is useful. But one of the things perhaps that's possible to evoke is what you have faith in when you do this practice. Or if you don't care for the word faith, what you trust. Or if you don't trust the word trust, maybe confidence, what you have confidence in. And that brings you home, brings you here. That reminds you that just to do this turning inside, not to disconnect from the world exactly, but to come home and settled. And or perhaps a how is a how of cherishing or valuing this moment and this time. The Buddha said that the Dharma's onward leading, and I interpret that to mean that if we can just show up and really be here in a full way without having an attitude of striving and pushing and goal orientation and trying to get something, it kind of works out. It's kind of like the momentum, the onward leading kind of begins to work in spite of ourselves. And so when I did the Mahasi practice, I did a lot of just being, coming in, settling down, just being here in a very trusting, faith-filled kind of way, that it was enough just to show up. And I also, in the how, I didn't try to do it well. I certainly didn't try to do it perfect. And I had this idea that if I tried to do it perfect, if I did it just 100%, like just nonstop, just right, it wasn't going to work. Like, it's better if I did it 70% and be relaxed about it, and then somehow the how begins to kind of build momentum or grow, or the seed develops and germinates. And if that 30% or 40% or 80% where I wasn't doing it, I'd kind of drift off or something. If I was upset or that got me tightened up to force myself again and get back on track in a harsh way or anything like that, that would mess it up. And so I learned this wonderful art of compost or transformation, where whenever I found myself being distracted, I would turn that into the practice. I would just kind of let myself just be present for that. Here I'm just, this is what it's like for a mind to be wandering off. And I would reckon, oh, it's here, and I'm back. I'm here with that. Rather than say, yeah, this is, I made a mistake, I got it wrong. I would transform it into a place to have a whole lot of love, just here with this, like this. And then I would, start the practice again. So I hope that I trust that each of you perhaps have some sense from your practice already that there's a how that supports you, and that as you sit down, you want to maybe evoke something of the how, and maybe there's some of the how, even when you feel very differently, maybe there's something about an attitude that you can have that is bigger or more underlying that you can evoke that supports you in doing the instruction. Now, in terms of the what, for sitting meditation, the way that I was taught this Mahasi approach uses what's called an anchor. A place that is I think of it as the home for the practice, and where two things have a chance to develop together, cultivating greater attentiveness, mindfulness, and developing stability or concentration. And the way that it's traditionally taught in Mahasi is to use the movements of the body as your breathing. And so the classic instruction is to be with the what's called the rising and falling of the belly as we breathe. If you can relax your belly as you breathe, then sometimes you'll feel this belly, they say it's rising, but it's kind of moving out and becoming bigger, expanding and contracting. That's called rising and falling. And though some people feel the movements more in their chest or in their side rib cage or some other places. And it's also fine to do the sensations of the air going in and out through the nostrils. But wherever it's most compelling. And in ordinary language, it's called, you know, following the breath. However, Mahasi was very explicit that this is not breath meditation we're doing, but rather it's a what he called four elements meditation, which is a sensation-based focus. We're kind of tuning into the physical sensations that come into play as the belly moves. And it just the fact that we're breathing is just a coincidence. You know, it's kind of like we're tuning into the biggest movement in the body when we're sitting still, and then tuning in and kind of savoring and sensing and feeling and receiving the sensations that are there. And the sensation meditation doesn't involve a lot of thinking about something, but more a kind of openness, a kind of quietness, of awareness that receives or is filled by with, connected to those sensations. And of course the mind will wander away, and the fact that I say of course is an encouragement to be relaxed about that, but not complacent about it. If you're too complacent, then maybe we allow ourselves to drift off in thought too much. But to be relaxed means we're not making it a problem, but we do begin again, begin again, begin again. And then the last thing I'll say about this Mahasi practice, it puts emphasis or encouragement, but not the requirement, to use what's called mental noting. And this is the art, and I call it an art because it's something to learn for a while. Or I think it's like if you're learning to ride a bicycle, at first it's wobbly, but after a while it gets smoother and smoother, and after a while you can say, look, no hands. So after a while, it takes a while to kind of learn the art of the mental noting, but after it's kind of wobbly for a while, it settles down and becomes kind of second nature. And it's a way of using thoughts to help us stay present rather than leaving our thoughts alone to do whatever they want to do, and which is probably, an idle mind gets in trouble, just wanders off. And so it's also a way of encouraging us to just stay with the primary object, with the anchor, or whatever we're paying attention to. And then it's also how we do the mental note. Remember, the how is so important. So how we do the mental note is important. And so to find a way that is not harsh, is not striving, is not hesitant, is not resistant, but kind of matter-of-fact way that maybe even loving or connected, so as we feel the breathing, the movements of the belly or the chest, very gently saying, rising. As you exhale, falling. And saying that is kind of like a little reminder, like a little subtle voice in the background, not in the foreground, that's telling you, encouraging you lovingly, stay right there with the experience of rising. Stay right there and sense and feel the sensations of falling, of exhaling. And just kind of in a very steady, relaxed, easygoing kind of way, make that mental note to kind of stay, like stay right there. It's okay. It's okay, stay there. It's okay, stay, rising, falling. Some people use other notes for being with the, what we call the breathing. Some people do in and out. Maybe that works a little bit better, maybe with the sensations going in and out through the nostrils. So that's what I'll just say for now, and each of these things we'll kind of refine as we go along. But this is the first day of the retreat, and just settling in here, and you all have some sense of practice and how to settle in on your own. You've done this before, hopefully. And so now, maybe if you start with this mental noting and the simplicity of breathing, maybe what I said today is enough for now, and the first day is often just settling in and helping the mind settle, and the momentum of thinking and thoughts and feelings that we come to retreat with have the chances to settle out, and because we're sitting quietly and not feeding them and not getting involved in them as so much. So, sitting upright, perhaps taking a few long, slow, deep breaths. Perhaps as you exhale, settling in to, not just settling in physically, but maybe settling into an attitude that's useful. How? Some attitude that is supportive of being really here, now, and in this body at this time. And then letting the breathing return to normal. And perhaps it's useful to take a few moments to scan the body to see if there's any obvious places that'd be useful to relax and soften, and if you're holding anything tight or contracted, to soften, relax while staying upright. And then to connect to the sensations that are connected to breathing, to become aware of how the body experiences the movements or the sensations of breathing. And as you tune into the body's experience of breathing, it's also helpful to take a few moments to adjust the how you're aware. It might be helpful to have a simplicity of awareness. Perhaps in the simplicity of it, to see if there can be a clarity of awareness as you feel the rising and falling sensations, the movements connected to breathing, the sensations. Perhaps giving yourself the benefit of the doubt that you're practicing just fine or good enough for now, as you give yourself over to being aware of the sensations connected to breathing. And then very gently, as a whisper in the mind, you might have a mental note for the experience of breathing in and breathing out. Maybe the classic one of rising, falling. Perhaps using the mental note a little bit with the attitude of yes. Yes to being aware. as you're sitting here, becoming clear about what's happening. Perhaps if you're with your breathing, to refresh the attention so it's clear what the experience of rising and falling, what the sensations are. And if you're not with the breathing, if you've drifted off in thought, becoming clear about that fact. Not making it a problem, but making it something to be clear about that it's happening. And then whenever you can, begin again with the body's sensations of breathing. When I began the practice in Burma, I arrived. They gave me a little cassette tape player and a cassette, which contained the instructions for the retreat. It was like a 30 or 45 minute cassette in English. That was the primary instructions for the 8 months that I was on retreat. And it kind of was the complete set of the instructions. And what's happened here in the West, we've adapted that usually to spread out the instructions over a series of days, just to keep it simpler and maybe a little bit better match for how kind of what becomes important as the days goes along sometimes. But if I was going to summarize those instructions in a very simple way that included everything, was that first, everything that could be experienced qualifies as something to be mindful of. So it's very inclusive, and it's very powerful to learn that everything in our experience can be met with this clarity of mindfulness, or the what I like to even call the freedom of mindfulness. So we find some clarity, freedom, a how to be with it that's maybe somewhat different or radically different than how we would be kind of habitually involved in things as they occur, where preferences arise and being for and against arises. And the way it was taught was there was an anchor, which we were told should be the breathing, though sometimes people use different anchors. And if the breathing doesn't work for some of you as an anchor, as a primary home for mindfulness, we can talk about other options. And the idea is to kind of stay there and develop the mindfulness concentration there on the breathing. But if anything else became compelling or anything else pulls the attention away from the breathing, that's completely fine, because then that becomes the place to be mindful, to have clarity and to be present for. And it isn't like you have to think that, you know, this is second, you know, not as important as the experience of breathing, and I better get back to the breathing quickly. If something else is compelling or something else has pulled you away, that becomes the practice in its own right. And we're there with it until it either goes away or until it no longer has that compelling feeling or longer has the pull of attention. And then begin again with the experience of breathing, the body's experience of breathing. I'm trying not to say be with the breathing, because it's not a breath meditation per se. It's a sensation meditation. And then to be there. If things are not compelling enough or really pull you away, I think of the mindfulness or like the being present for the breathing kind of like the umbrella in the rain. All kinds of things can happen. All kinds of rain can fall from the sky, but it just washes off the side of the umbrella and, you know, you keep dry somehow. So all kinds of thoughts and feelings can happen, sounds and stuff. But, you know, kind of if you're staying with the anchor, then the mindfulness is there. Just imagine that everything else just kind of washing off to the side. It's not rejecting it. It's not being close to it exactly, but you don't need to bother with it. It's there, and it's there on the edges of awareness, and it just kind of washes away right away. And that's also a little bit different than how some people are, where there might be some kind of mental preference for certain kinds of thoughts, certain kinds of feelings. It might be an attitude that something might not be compelling or pull us, except that we're so interested in the future. Or, you know, we have so interested in the past, or so interested in, you know, particular nuances of our feelings and psychology and things. And it's that extra interest that we have that maybe is not needed. The thoughts and the feelings, the emotions are fine to have. And so rather than getting interested, or it's just kind of let it all kind of wash off the umbrella of mindfulness. And the focus is on the anchor, or the, I call it the home base, the place to be at home with. So the, and then these mental notes, noting, one of the values of doing it is that if you pay attention to the tone of voice with which you make the mental note, that might be a very clear, sometimes, indication of what your attitude is to doing the practice. Because I've noticed sometimes that I've started noting and I don't really like what's going on, or I'm impatient, and the noting starts getting impatient, or there's a tone of harshness or impatience, like, or there's a, or I'm not, you know, I'm kind of drifting off, I'm kind of lackadaisical, and the notes are kind of like have this very lazy, I'll get around to it sometime quality. You know, I'm not really there for it. And so there's all these attitudes that can be embedded in the voice. And sometimes the first time I notice that I have some unnecessary attitude about my practice is the tone of the inner voice that's making it. And the art of making these mental notes is to figure out how to do it at the right kind of intensity. If it's an ordinary discursive kind of conversational kind of way of thinking, it's probably too loud in the mind. And so can you tune it down to a more quiet channel of mental noting? That's, you know, it's a quieter channel of thinking than having discursive thought. And finding just the right channel is kind of like, you know, the art of it, until it feels like it's on par with what's appropriate to help you stay present. And finally, one of the little things that I found useful with mental noting, especially when it got mechanical or felt a little bit too dry or harsh, or it's like too much energy in the mind or something, was I just imagined I was saying a note. And somehow, when I just imagine I'm doing it, I'm still doing it, kind of, but in my imagination. Where else is it going to be? It's in the mind, right? What's the difference between saying a mental note and imagining? Somehow the imagining, it's like kind of much more, it's like almost no energy, no agitation of the mind. It's almost like, it's like this, it's more virtual than a thought. It kind of doesn't exist. Anyway, so that was a little trick that I found useful. Just imagine I'm doing it, and that would keep me on track. And sometimes, so I say that to you, all these things about this song I did and this imagining, making mental note, to indicate to you that there is some creativity in getting the instructions and finding how to tailor it for ourselves and find how it really supports just showing up and being present and being here in a way that, with an attitude and a how that is useful, how that creates the nutrient-rich soil in which your inner practice can grow and develop. And for this first day, in terms of sitting meditation, I think it's generally useful to keep it really simple. And one way to do that is just stay with the breath when you sit, and just kind of keep coming back and coming back, and kind of let all the other momentum of your life kind of have a life and have it, you know, spin out or settle out, fall off the umbrella. And of course, you know, this first day of the retreat is, I think most of you know, can be a difficult day with, the body adjusts and body aches and tiredness and unresolved issues of our life come pouring in, and momentum of our daily life and thoughts. And some people are so excited about coming to retreat and they think that their home practice of sitting every day is kind of sweet and nice, and they just build on that and go so deep quickly, slide right in. And then the first day of retreat, their mind is just so much more busy than it is at home. How did that happen? You know, but there's no mistakes on retreat. It's all part of the practice. It's everything that occurs is composted in, is included in. Just one more thing to be aware of. And it'll keep unfolding. And if this first day of the retreat you need to take a nap or two or three, maybe that's part of the process. It's healthy for you and helpful for you to settle in and kind of, you know, you don't want to start a marathon by running as fast as you can. So sometimes on a retreat, you don't want to start the retreat, but just kind of like, you know, just all out. But maybe the first day or two, maybe kind of allow yourself to kind of settle in and come. So I hope you enjoy the day. And Brian now will give some instructions for walking meditation.
Feel free as I begin to share with you the walking meditation instructions. Since we've been sitting here for a little while, you can stand up, you can move your body a little bit and stretch, so please don't be shy about that in terms of moving your body as I'm speaking to you. For the walking meditation instruction, I kind of want to use the framework that Gil was using to share a little bit about the how that we can bring to walking meditation, and then what. And when I reflect on the how do I engage in walking meditation, what comes to mind, actually what came to mind this morning, are just these few lines from a poem by Anne Sexton that she wrote. It was a poem for a young woman coming of age. And the lines are very simple. She says to this young woman, "Oh, darling, let your body in. Let your body in gently. And for me, when I take those words in, it's this quality of receiving, letting in the bodily experience. Or as Gil was mentioning about even the rise and fall of the abdomen, the world of sensation, and allowing it in a gentle manner. And when I also take into account the context of that poem, sometimes I think maybe all practice is we're coming of age, you know, into the Dharma. It's really the same process of navigating, just probably as that young woman, again, imagining a young woman in the late 50s, early 1960s, coming of age, of navigating all the individual suffering and dukkha. But not only that, also the societal dukkha, the societal suffering that all of us have to navigate on the cushion in the walking meditation. And so much of the how is that gentleness of allowing the body in. So a strong encouragement of just how healing walking meditation can be, and how it creates the foundation also for the heart's release, for awakening. So again, this how, the quality of receiving in particular sensation. And the what we're going to be doing. In many ways, it's exactly what Gil was talking about. We're just switching the anchor. Now the anchor is the sensations on the bottoms of the feet. And again, just like the rise and fall of the abdomen doesn't work for everyone, in the same way, there might be a few people that doesn't work as an anchor, and so it's sometimes exploring a different anchor, for example, the feeling of the legs moving. But if that does work, it can be a wonderful thing to come back to again and again and again, just as you would come back to the sensations within the activity of breathing. And I think probably most of you are familiar with this this arena of just picking a lane of 20 or 30 feet long and walking back and forth, and having that as the context. The other piece that I find especially important at the beginning of retreat for walking meditation that allows the mind to settle is to take in anything pleasurable that you feel on the bottoms of the feet, and really learning this art of savoring pleasure. And there's physiological significance to this, because when my mind can take in pleasure and really fully allow pleasure in, what it's giving the physiology the feedback that this is safe right now. Oh, actually, this is safe. It's safe to allow pleasure in. For example, if you're being chased by a mountain lion, hopefully your physiology is not taking in pleasure. It needs to respond. It needs to respond quickly. And that system of taking in pleasure shuts down in a certain manner. And it's important that it does. It's just that for many of us, and I think this is the societal piece, not all of us, but many of us probably have this habitual conditioning that it feels like there's some mountain lion in the background subtly waiting for us. And I also want to acknowledge there might be good reason, given, you know, how we were brought up or the society we were brought up in or the family. So it's important that the system gets that it's safe. Because I can tell you you're safe. But have you noticed that it can be such a long journey for the system to really get that it's safe? And that's really some of the process of samadhi, of the mind collecting. So just an encouragement to savor, really bring in anything pleasurable about the walking meditation, especially the sensations on the bottoms of the feet. And then in terms of the pace, get a feeling for the pace that works for you. For the first couple days, it might be walking at a little bit more quick speed. The noting that comes with that a lot of times is just left, right. You could just be noting, labeling each foot. And remembering the noting is not so much to mark the movement of the foot, it's to respond to it. I feel the left foot move. I feel the sensations on the left foot change, and in response, there's the noting of left. And this is really helpful for me, because sometimes I notice that the noting starts to become mechanical, and I'm just saying it as a way of kind of trying to keep up with the activity, rather than as an indication of noticing the activity. And then there might be space where it feels more appropriate to slow down, where it's just the noticing and the labeling of lifting and placing of each foot. And then even more slowly, really getting into just that very slow quality of feeling the lifting of the foot, the moving of it, and the placing of it. And when I move into this slow kind of walking meditation, I have the feet, I take my gait is much, much shorter, so that I can feel the lifting, moving, and placing on one foot before the other foot comes up, so that I'm dividing the activity of the lifting and the placing to really fully be with them. And it's the same if the mind is pulled away from those sensations, or there's another experience that's more compelling, to take time with that. And that becomes the object of your meditation. And then returning to this anchor of the sensations on the bottoms of the feet. And then also an encouragement to take some time with the ends of your lane. So when I get to the end of the lane, I'm with the activity of standing. Sometimes I'll be with the activity of hearing, because it brings a quality of spaciousness, and it reminds me of this quality of receiving, of letting the body in. And then the activity of turning, those small, teeny, lifting, moving placings, and then beginning once again. And also, I guess I want to point out just something about the framework of this retreat. This rhythm of sitting and walking meditation, really, that you've probably been exposed to on many retreats, really does come from this Mahasi tradition. For those of you who've done, for example, Goenka retreats, there's a encouragement not to do walking meditation. And Mahasi Sayadaw would talk about how he felt that having this rhythm of sitting and walking meditation balances the energy and the effort needed for the practice. So just an encouragement to make best use of the walking meditation times for that balance of energy too, just as we enter into this retreat together. Okay, may you have many mindful steps. Thank you.